So when we last left off, which was 2 weeks ago, that was my bad. We were talking about David being rejected from building the Beis HaMikdash. And the basic theory we had was that David can't build the Beis HaMikdash because he's too much a man of action. And the whole point of the Beis HaMikdash is we need to understand that we don't do that for God. It's really the culmination of what he does for us. The culmination of everything he gives us as we enter Eretz Yisrael is him giving us the opportunity to have a place that we can come to interact with Hashem, to give Karbanos to Hashem, David Hashem, the Sefer Achinoch's description of the purpose of the mitzvah of building a Beis HaMikdash, the focus that Shlomo has when Shlomo davens, when constructing the Beis HaMikdash. And we're going to see now the next, as we proceed, is David as a man of action is going to be put on full display. Because Perek Ches, the next chapter, really is going to be David, you call it overnight empire. You know, all of a sudden he's going to transform from being like a local king to being an emperor. And what the questions we want to focus on are, what is David's attitude towards all of this? What is the Navi's attitude towards all of this? And we're basically going to see the two main goals, I think, for us to have in this year tonight. Number one is we're going to see like a shocking degree of disinterest that the Navi has and seemingly that David himself has in the amazing military successes of the Perek. Any other story in the history of nations and kings where you had a government and a country that had as much military success as David is going to have in this chapter, that would be the climax of the story. Yet, David's own perspective, the Navi's perspective, it's like sideline. So we'll notice that. And the other thing is going to be to, we're going to make a few methodological points, which I think are going to help us as we build up towards David and Bathsheba, which we're really going to get into in a couple of weeks. But already now, the prakim before the David and Bathsheba story, which is really going to be the key for us to understand David HaMelech, the Navi is already going to be giving us some crumbs to think about as we approach that story. So a little bit of this screen share, and we'll start. So we start with one pasuk, and the one pasuk is incredible. It's only one pasuk long. Navi tells one pasuk, Achrechin, after the whole episode of David and Nasan HaNavi and the Yishud Beis HaMikdash, Vayach David es HaPlishtim, Vayach Ni'im. David attacks the Plishtim, he subdues them, Vayikach David es Mesig Ha'ama Miyad Plishtim. He takes whatever, takes exactly whatever Mesig Ha'ama is. Most of the Mepharshim understand that this was Gat, the central city of the Plishtim. And that's it. Now this is absolutely incredible because the Jews have been fighting the Plishtim for hundreds of years by now. And for most of the time, the Jews have been losing. They were fighting in the time of Shamgar and Devora. They were fighting in the time of Shimshon, in the time of Shmuel, in the time of Shaul. And for the most part, Bnei Yisrael were losing. The Plishtim succeeded in destroying the Mishkan. I mean, they invaded all the way and conquered almost the whole country in Shiloh. And now David has won a victory, which was literally unfathomable. You know, for years, the dream Bnei Yisrael had was at least we can have some independence from the Plishtim, some security, just give us a little bit of breathing space for them to not control us to the degree that we can't even have our own metal, make our own farm tools. They were paying massive taxes to the Plishtim, enslaved by the Plishtim. Now we have the moment where after all those years, going back to the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, you know, we're halfway through the second Sefer since the Plishtim have been a problem, and David wins an unbelievable victory. He goes on the offensive. Not only are we liberated from the Plishtim, but we have conquered the Plishtim. And what attention does the Navi give to it? One pasuk. That's it. One pasuk for the victory. This should have been like the ultimate ke'ula. And it gets one pasuk. There are no details. There's no description of the battle. There's no description of anything at all. Just we're told, oh, by the way, he beats the Plishtim and he takes Meseg Ha'ama, which Navi doesn't even bother to make clear what it is. He leaves it from the Farshim to try to figure out what exactly this thing is. That's mind-boggling that that's done in one pasuk. And then, as we continue to a few more pesukim, we see the Navi follows this pattern again and again. David fights against Moab, and we're told in one pasuk that David defeats Moab. We'll come back in a couple of minutes to look at some of the details of what happens over here. But one pasuk, he defeats the Plishtim. One pasuk, he defeats Moab. Then David goes up to the north. He fights against Aram Tzova. Aram, we know, is, you know, modern-day Syria, to the northeast of Eretz Yisrael. At the time of David, Aram was divided up into a few different small kingdoms. There's Aram Tzova, Aram Damesek, Aram Naharayim, Aram Rehov, one other one. You have a whole bunch of different small kingdoms of Aram. They had fought against Bnei Yisrael going back to the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. The very first Shofet we have in Sefer Shoftim, Othniel ben Kenaz, fights against Aram, who seems to have conquered most of Eretz Yisrael. Shaul also fights against Aram. David fights him. And we're told in two psukim that David defeats Hadadezer, the king of Aram Tzova. Unclear what exactly this guy was doing. Some of the farshim understand that he was getting an army ready to invade. But whatever's happening, two psukim. So we have one pasuk for the Plishtim, one pasuk for Moab, two psukim for Aram Tzova. Then pasuk hey tells us that the king of Aram Damesek comes to help Hadadezer. David beats them too, another tremendous victory. So five psukim, and we've had four major victories over different countries. You know, and then we scroll down a little bit to, you know, David takes a break. For some reason, we have a break to talk about all the spoils that David takes. And then let me ride over. How far down did I go? Sorry. Yeah, David comes back from fighting Aram, puts up a monument, and he also conquers Edom. Five countries, right? And it's just boom, 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 boom. No details, no extensive descriptions. In practice, this must have taken years, right? There's no way. There's a limited fighting season. The Navi is going to talk about that in a couple of prakim. We get closer to David and Bathsheba. There's no way that David did all of this in 1 year. This is the work of years and years. We're going to see Perek and Tehillim, which makes that very clear. This makes it seem like an overnight empire. And no real excitement about it. You know, the Navi then continues. Okay, so Navi tells us, Vayosh Hashem es David mikol asher halach. Okay, first time we're told that Hashem saved, Hashem is giving David the victory. Wonderful. Then the Navi spends two psukim talking about some of the spoils that David takes from the battle. There is more detail about the spoils that David brings home than about the actual victories that David wins. He takes the Shiltei HaZahav, here 1917 JPS, translated as golden shields, which some of the Mufarshim understand. Rashi thinks that it means a golden quiver, like to put arrows into decorative golden quivers, whatever it was for the palace guard. So David is bringing gold to Yerushalayim. David is bringing the Choshes, right? It's bringing copper to Yerushalayim. But like, no big deal. Going through it, bam, 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 bam. You know, I think like the first battle that Shaul fights against the Plishtim is two prakim long. David and Goliath is like 40 psukim long. This, the greatest victory, and then the transformation from small kingdom to empire, it happens in the blink of an eye. Right. The, The Malbim points out something which is related to this. The Malbim notes that the parak begins by telling us Vahi Achrechein, it was afterwards. So the Malbim says we have to understand that this is being connected to the previous episode of David being told that he's not going to build the Beis HaMikdash, but that his son is going to, and that there's more work to do. So the Malbim understands that David now knows that he's going to keep on fighting. Okay, so naturally he goes to battle. Taking like the more basic point that the Malbim has, that Vahi Achrechein is linking the spoil, the battles here with the success, with the previous message about the Beis HaMikdash. So we might wonder about this emphasis on the spoils. Can the spoils have something to do with the connection to the Beis HaMikdash. Rashi says, yes, that's exactly the point. I'm going to skip the piece of Noav now. We'll come back to it in a minute. After all those battles, so the Navi then tells us that having won a whole bunch of victories over surrounding powers, there's somebody, Towi, the king of Hamas, so that's like near the Kinneret. So he hears that David had defeated Aram. Towi sends his son to give a bracha to David, and he has more gold and silver and copper with him. His name is Yoram, which the Dat Mikra points out that is, that's a shocking name. That's a Jewish name. Yoram, right? The Yo, that's a reference to Yudke Vavke. Dat Mikra suggests his name had originally been Eliram, my God is mighty, right? He changes it to Hashem is mighty. So he sends his son who has a, there seems to be a monotheistic attitude over here. He's giving bracha to David. He's giving spoils to David. David is donating those. Gam osam higdish hamelach David l'Hashem im hakasef azav asher higdish mikol hagem asher kibish. David donated all the spoils to the Beis HaMikdash, and he donated this to the Beis HaMikdash as well. Aram, Moab, we haven't seen a couple of these victories yet. Ammon and Amalek, those victories the Navi just dropped off of the page and from the Shlal of Hadadezer ben Rehov, Melech Tzoba. So Rashi comes in with the first main point. Rashi just tells us, Kol HaParshios Halalu Samchan Etzal Parsha Shel Beis HaMikdash. Why do we squeeze all this here next to the Beis HaMikdash? David is fighting all these battles. He's collecting more and more gold for the Beis HaMikdash. And the broader point here seems to be that David is not interested. His focus is not on military conquest per se. David is not excited by the conquest. The Navi is not excited by the conquest and victory and empire. Where David's mind still is, he is still squarely locked in on the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the dream that he is going to build it has been crushed, but the dream for his son to build it is alive and well, and David has transitioned to planning actively and vigorously for the future. And stunningly, what in any other story in the history of military success would have been a story of conquest and empire, for the Navi here, it's about all the opportunities that David has to bring more and more and advance the preparations for the ultimate goal, which is not the empire, it is the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. It tells us where David's mindset is, and it's an excellent place, and it tells us where the Navi thinks that our mindset should be. Now, this gets taken to another level if we consider the parallel which the Navi here is suggesting to a previous biblical figure, because there is one other person in Jewish history who fights major battles in the Northeast, in the area of Aram and Damasek, and brings home tremendous spoil and seems to take none of the spoil for himself. And there's another random king, you know, after beating a whole bunch of kings, there's another random king who comes and sends him a bracha, and that other king seems to have a monotheistic bent. Of course, that is Avram Avinu in the battle of the four kings, the five kings, when he defeats here I guess David fought, David defeats five people. So one more than Avraham. But Avraham coming back from the four kings, and Malki Tzedek, Melech Yerushalayim, comes out to greet him. And all of a sudden, the king of Yerushalayim comes out to greet Avraham Avinu. Kohen Lekel Elyon, this is what the Torah said about Malki Tzedek, coming to give bracha to Avraham Avinu. And of course, the whole central theme there was that despite all the military success, A, Avraham was not changed. B, his eye was on the ball, right? He was not keeping any of the spoils for himself. He is totally disassociated from Sodom. He's totally uncorrupted by his acquisition of wealth. The world of money, the world of Sodom has nothing to do with Avraham Avinu. So we have here something very similar with David, right? The connection the Navi is drawing between David's victories and Avraham's victory seems to be pointing another neon light. Don't think about armies and conquests and empire. Focus on the spoils. Just like in Avram's victory, the clear message of the Chumash was to focus on the spoils and Avram's refusal to take anything for himself. So too here, the Navi is flashing. Look at what is happening with the spoils. That's the whole point of the story over here, is David is focused on Beis HaMikdash, not focused on military conquest. Military conquest is wonderful. The Navi tells us once, and it tells us twice. One pasuk again later, after David defeats Edom, by Yosha Hashem as David, we call Asher Halach. Twice we're told that Hashem is the one running the show. No surprise to us. But David is not in it for the victories per se. He's in it for the right reasons, right? That's basic point number one. Just the degree to which the Navi skips, you know, runs through all of the military victories as quickly as possible gets really highlighted if we take a look at Sefer Tehillim, Perek Samach. It's a small parak over here. And what Tehillim Perek Samach actually is it shows us David's experience when fighting these battles. Anatzeach al Shushan Edus Mechtam David Lamed, Bahatzoso Es Aram Na'arayim Ves Aram Tzova, Vayashav Yoav Vayach Es Adom Begei Melach Shneim Asar Aleph. Those are the battles of this parak, the battles against Aram Naraim and Aram Tzova and against Edom, which Navi and Shmuel will come back to a little bit in a couple of prakim. But here we blitzed through it. The whole, those battles were covered in four psukim, and it made it sound like it happened in one day that he beats the Plishtim and Aram Tzova, Aram Naraim and Moav and Edom. And take a look at what David's experience actually was when fighting those battles. It begins amazingly. Elohim zinachtanu pratztanu. Hashem, you've abandoned us and you've broken us. Anafta teshofev lanu. You've been angry. Please bring us back. What? What? Apparently, these battles were brutally difficult. And as you read pasuk after pasuk in the parak, it's clear that David and Yoav suffered losses. Not just hard battles, right? They won the war, but they lost battles on the way. And there was even a crisis of faith. Here, Isa Amcha Kasha, we've seen terrible things. Hishkisanu Yain Tarela. Yain Tarela, that's a language for punishment that Hashem has made them drink, disgusting wine. Right? Save us, answer us. Right. Where are the victories? But David says, I know that Hashem is all powerful. Hashem says, Li Gilad, Li Menashe, Ephraim, Moab, and Edom. Hashem is in total control of Moab and Edom and the Plishtim. And yet, David is not winning victories. Halo ata lokim zenachtanu velo teitze lokim etzevoseinu. Where is Hashem in our army? They feel abandoned. Give us help. David and Yoav doesn't believe in man, right? He turns to Hashem for help, but he's turning to help because he's obviously having difficulties. And he closes on a pasuk of total amunu bitachon. Right? David has total faith and trust that ultimately Hashem is going to crush his enemies. But it's obvious from the parak that David suffered significant setbacks. And yet, none of that is in our parak in Shmuel. We just make it sound like it was an easy, instant victory. Boom, boom, boom. It's fascinating. There are so many lessons we could have learned from the battles, but it sounds like the Navi does not want us focusing on the military victory, even though it's, not since the days of Yehoshua. The Medrash says that Yehoshua is the Rosh HaKovshin, Yehoshua is the greatest of the conquerors. Well, David is in second place. And it all happens right here, but the Navi just whoop runs through it. Don't focus on the success, focus on David's attitude. David's attitude towards all of this is all getting us one step closer to that position of safety and security and peace, which with we finally can build a Beis HaMikdash. He's not looking at the empire as an end in and of itself. He's looking at it as the means to the ultimate vision of Bnei Yisrael in peace and of peace and security. Truth is, if we can even push this a couple of steps further, because it's not just amazing that David accomplishes military victories in this parish, and that they, there's an empire that's being built in this parish. You know, we went from, you know, David being like one guy by himself as a fugitive to being at the head of a few men running around in the desert to a kingdom of Yehuda and Hebron to a united kingdom in Eretz Yisrael to now all of a sudden an empire really in control on both sides of the Jordan River. There's even more than that that David's accomplished here, that the Navi just isn't so interesting. You know, if we go back to the story of Abraham and the four kings, so right afterwards is where Hashem appears to David, to Abraham one parak later. And it is in that parak, right after the victory of the four kings, that Hashem tells David, that tells Abraham what the borders of Eretz Yisrael are going to be, what the maximal borders of Eretz Yisrael are going to be. Now, they're the minimal borders, what we actually conquered in the time of Yehoshua. But then there's the maximum borders of how far can Eretz Yisrael expand. And Hashem tells Avram right here, here's the bris. Lazarachan nasatias eretz hazos, minar mitzrayim, bad nahar gadol nahar pras. From the river of Egypt, wherever exactly that is, somewhere in the Sinai desert, until the Euphrates in the north. Well, what is the point in history at which this nevuah is actually fulfilled? It happens in our parak. David defeats the Plishtim, takes over in the Gaza Strip, so he extends his dominion down to Nahar Mitzrayim. Then he goes up to the north and defeats Aram Naharaim, and extends his control to Nahar Pras, the Euphrates River. So this is the parak where the ultimate goal and the ultimate vision of what the maximal borders of Bnei Yisrael could be have been achieved. You know, you said Yehoshua was the head of the conquerors, but Yehoshua didn't conquer all of Eretz Yisrael. And there was so much attention paid to the conquest. Sefer Yehoshua, it's a whole book. David actually finishes the job in this parak, and yet we're just not interested in the victories per se. What's the point of it all? Because once you have achieved all the victory, now you can go ahead with the base of Mikdash. And that is what we're locked in on. And this one step to push it one step further. Not only is this amazing salvation, an amazing victory, and building an empire, and achieving the border, the maximum boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. But this parak was the fulfillment of at least a major chunk of Bilam's last nevuah. Bilam's fourth nevuah, when he looks far out into the future, and he says, Arenu v'lo'ata, shenu v'lo'karov, I see far off one day in the future, said Bilam. Right, there's a star and a scepter coming out of Yisrael. And what's it going to do? Machatz pase Moab, the karkar kol b'nei Shais. It's going to strike Moab. It's going to strike all of Shais. Edom Yeresha. Yeresha si'irai vav. He's going to conquer Moab. He's going to conquer Edom. Says Rashi, who is Bilam prophesying about, at least in this part of the Nevuah? Says Rashi, Zeh David. Ashkeva some arts of Yimesh Nechalim Lamis Vigomer. He quotes our parak, Shmuel Beis, parak Chas, Pasuk Beis, the ancient Nevuas of Bilam, that one day, Darach Kochav Miyakov, right? And Rashi says the second half of the Nevuah is about the Yimei HaMashiach. For the first half, there's going to be a Mashiach one day in the you know, distant future. In the future, there's going to be, someone else is going to come. That happened now. Like Bilam's, you know, far off in the future, Nevuah is being fulfilled, and we get to it, and it's like, oh, okay, you know, humdy dum. Next, move on. Let's get through it. Move. That's not really what the focus is. It's amazing. It's absolutely staggering. And I think it really drives home for us what David's attitude is in the entire experience, and what our attitude is supposed to be. Right, as the parak goes on, so the Navi then basically brings this all home. There's a beautiful Rashi quoted from Chazal about this. So Navi says, with all these conquests, so Vayimloch David al kol Yisrael, so David is king of all of Israel, wonderful. But he David oseh mishpat utzdaka l'chol amo. So David does justice and tzedek for his whole nation. And that's the dream. That's what the king is supposed to do. The very next pasuk tells us, Yoav ben Tsruya al hatzava. Yoav is in charge of the army. We'll talk about him in a couple of weeks. And then the Navi gives us, you know, three pesukim about David's cabinet. It's pretty small. But Rashi quotes, it's a Gemara in Brachos, which talks about this juxtaposition of David as the king doing tzedek and mishpat, right? He's judging, and Yoav with the army. Rashi quotes Chazal, and Rashi says that these were related. David garam liyav liyos matzleach halatzava lefi sha'asa mishpat utzaka. It's David's justice on the home front that enables the military success. The Yoav garam leDavid lasos mishpat utzaka lefi shu dam Yoav shote berod al gada. David is able to do the justice because Yoav is his enforcer. Here's a really key point. Since Yoav is busy with the military matters, lo haya David tara behen. David did not have to spend so much time with the army. The libo pasuch mishpat tzedek, that makes David able, it gives him the option to be where he wants to be, where his heart lies, and his heart does not lie with the army and the fighting and the conquest. His heart lies with the world of mishpat and tzedek, which is exactly the message that the parak has over here. So David and Yoav are in a symbiotic relationship. The Hashem is with the army because of David's mishpat and tzedek, and that is why Hashem is in that, so it allows him to succeed. And then mitzvah goreres mitzvah, right? Mitzvah leads to mitzvah. The fact that they're having success allows David to be where he wants to be, focusing on mishpat and tzedek. So that end of the parak really just ties the whole thing in the bow, where the conquest is wonderful. You know, we shouldn't go too far in the opposite direction. Remember once I was in YU, and somebody came and said that Judaism is like totally against conquest, and that Hashem gave us the land of Israel because it's located in a place where you can't possibly have an empire, because we're not supposed to have any conquest. And it's like, that sounds very nice, but it's not actually true. I mean, like, you know, David, Moshe's last bracha to us, the end of the bracha is, V'atal b'mosei musedro. Like, if people are going to be our enemies, then Hashem will let us defeat them. It's a bracha that David, you know, all the enemies who are around us attacked us, David's able to conquer them instead. But the focus is not on the conquest per se, it's on everything which is able to come out of that. Being able to have a society of Mishpat and Tzedek, and Yoav is out there fighting, and David can be with the city in Yerushalayim and the judging and the building based on Mikdash and preparing for the ultimate shot. That is, from beginning to end, what the parak wants to drive home for us. Okay, so we should now, with that major piece over there, what the parak as a whole is focusing on, want to now shift to think a little bit of methodology. And also, we'll see a piece which I think will help equip us as we get to David and Bathsheba in a couple of weeks. I want to go back and discuss in a little bit more detail the what was the one pasuk, right? The one pasuk about David and Moav. So the Navi told us that David attacks Moav. V'ayimadadein b'chevel hashkevo sam arza. He measured them with a line. And 2/3 of the men there, of the prisoners of war, he kills, and 1/3 he keeps alive, and they pay tribute to David. It's extremely brutal and harsh, and invites the moral question of how can this be okay, and it also invites just like the pshat question of why on earth is David doing this. So this is a great chance to see the pshat versus drash on a pasuk where we feel uncomfortable, and then somewhere in the middle. It's the view of Rashi, the view of Abarbanel, and the view of the Ramban. Rashi says about this pasuk, why was David so harsh against Moav? He says, "V'fishahargu es aviv es imo ve'achiv," because Moav murdered his father, his mother, and all of his brothers. Now, that's not in the text, but if we take it, then it will explain a whole bunch of things. There's a classic piece right? Where reading drash, but not, but reading drash with sophistication, we're filling in the gaps in the psukim. There is a missing piece of information, which if you plug in, is going to solve five or six different mysteries in the sefer, right? So Rashi gives us the first one. Now, Rashi says that, you know, the pasuk told us that when David first fled from Eretz Yisrael, so this is right when Noah V'Arkonim is going to be destroyed. So he drops off his family with the king of Moab. That makes sense because, first of all, Moab is David's family because we know Moab's David's great grandmother was Rus. And also, if you have a enemy fugitive of the king, so the natural refuge will be with other enemy kings. So David drops off his family with the king of Moab. Then David has to leave Moab because God, the Navi God, tells David, this may be a secure location, but you've got to leave. So David leaves. And then Rashi says, we never see David's family ever again. So why don't we ever see David's family again? One exception. There's one brother who shows up at the end of Shmuel Beis. So there's one brother who shows up. So you put it all together and Rashi says, okay, right? If you fill in that the minute that David left, the king of Moab betrays David and murders his whole family. So let's see how many mysteries that's going to resolve. It's going to explain why David is so brutal here. He's so brutal against Moab because it is a war of revenge, right? He's taking revenge here on them for betraying and murdering his own family. And that's why against Moab alone, against all these Plishtim and Aram, specifically it is Moab in which he behaves in this fashion. It's going to explain why we never see David's family again. It's going to explain why David has this only one brother who survives that we encounter. And now a couple of prakim later, David is going to send a Nichum Avelim delegation to the king of Ammon, right, the neighbor of Moab. And Rashi is going to explain, he sends a Nichum Avelim delegation to the king of Ammon. David in the Pasuk says, because his father did chesed to me, David, Rashi will say, what's the chesed? The chesed is, he took care, he saved that one fugitive brother. So it's going to explain that piece. It develops the general trajectory of Moab going back to their original origins. Moab, who is the older son of Lot from his older daughter. And Lot's whole general trajectory was that, you know, they tried to have their cake and eat it too. Literally, live in Sodom and enjoy all the wealth and luxury over there, but still hold on to his gemilas chasadim. I can invite guests while I'm living in Sodom, but ultimately that totally fails, right? We get to Sefer Bamidbar, Sefer Dvarim, and we're told that that people from Moab would not even let Bnei Yisrael cross their borders, and they're bringing Bilam in to curse them, right? You go from a world of luxury and Gilei Arayos and Chesed to where Moab ends up, which is luxury and Gilei Arayos and total cruelty. Chazal also points out when Moab and Ammon are born that Moab seems more ethically problematic than Ammon because the older daughter, right, or she names her daughter, she names her son Moav, Me'av, right, from my father, which is pretty chutzpahdik. So in that would, you know, you put it, plug it in over here as well. And Moab is the worst nation. They are the ones who are murdering David's family, while Ammon is a nation which is saving David's brother. Now, Ammon is also not going to behave very nicely, but at least they're doing something. The one other thing that this piece does, if you throw it in there, is it creates a parallel between David, whose entire family has just been wiped out, except for one surviving brother, and back there in Shmuel Aleph Parachav Beis, Shaul, right at that moment, Shaul wipes out all of the whole entire city of Nov Ir HaKohanim, except for one surviving Kohen who flees to David, and David takes responsibility. David says, if I hadn't been so reckless and come to Nov Ir HaKohanim, it never would have been destroyed. So, you know, what's happening to Hashem's Kohanim is also happening to David's family. You put it all together, it's amazing how many mysteries, how many pieces can be made to fit together when you just throw in this one piece. You know, it's like a scientific, a chemical reaction. You throw in the one enzyme, and all of a sudden, all these pieces are running around. It's like now it works beautifully. So that's one understanding of what is happening, right? Abarbanel, classic Abarbanel. So he quotes the Medrash. He says, "This is what's happening with Fichazal. Fichazal in Bamidbar Rava. What happened was that that David is acting so harshly against Moab because they wiped out his whole family." And take a look. Abarbanel says, "Fiapsha, Hayosezeh liaser haumbos shlo yisasku pam acharas ilachim Yisrael." So Abarbanel says, according to the Psha, David just did this to intimidate all of the other nations, which is an amazing line. I mean, it's kind of horrifying, right? Basically, David, according to this line, is not acting so differently from the Mongols or from the Assyrians, who you show up to a new country, the first city you attack, you turn into a mountain of skulls, and then all of a sudden, no one else is going to fight you, right? It's basically what Abarbanel is saying that David did. That's why David wipes out so much of Moab. Now, that's obviously extremely, extremely troubling. It's also difficult because we would have to ask if that's David's goal, right? He wants to instill deterrence. Then why is he doing this against Moab? Moab is the second nation that David just defeated. It would have made a lot more sense for David to do this against the first nation he defeated. He should have done it against the Plishtim. The Plishtim, who were, you know, Bnei Yisrael's age-old enemy for generations, that is where he should have, and a much more powerful country, by the way. The Plishtim are far more powerful than Moab. Moab is annoying, but Moab never threatened to conquer all of Eretz Yisrael. The Plishtim not only threatened to conquer all of Eretz Yisrael, they basically did. So why on earth would David do this deterrence move against Moab and not against the Plishtim? I wonder that. In fact, Abarbanel himself even slips back into Rashi's world. Like even Abarbanel. What does Abarbanel say at the end over here? He says, "V'acharesha David lakach mehem nikmaso v'nikmas Hashem." After David took his revenge and the revenge of Hashem, so then he leaves the rest of Moab to be, to pay tribute. Wait a second, what's David's revenge? What's Nikmaso that Abarbanel is referring to? Right, it's like Chazal, right? Rashi has found its way back into Abarbanel. So the general rule, whenever Abarbanel tells you the pshat, but then he like comes back to Chazal, so that's always a noteworthy, right? But there is no question that if you just look at the text itself, it indicates as what Abarbanel is saying. But this is a great model for us in terms of different, right? There are two different ways of reading the Perek, and you get two totally different images of David as a result. And one, the Pshat one, which is just focused on the Pasuk at hand, right? And then there's Rashi, which is looking from a broader view, and sometimes you have to bring something in from outside the text to really make the rest of the text make sense. There's no question that within Rashi's interpretation, there really is, Rashi seems untroubled by David's conduct. I want to show last few minutes how the Ramban takes an approach which is in the middle. Right? On the one hand, it's using a lot of the same midrashic technique that Rashi does. But at the same time, it is not shying away from the fact that, as Abarbanel points out, the pshat of the pasuk should leave us with a significant measure of discomfort about the brutality that David did, whether he felt it was necessary or not. And this middle approach of the Ramban, I think, is going to be absolutely essential as we get, as we gear up and get ready for David and Bashem. Let's take a look. The Rambam wrote Sefer Mitzvos, where he goes through all 613 Mitzvos. At the beginning of the Rambam's Sefer Mitzvos, so he has a he has an extended work, 14 Sharashim, where the Rambam gives his rules for what gets counted in the 613 mitzvot and what doesn't. And the Rambam is really locking in on the Bahag, Baal Halachas Gedolos, from the time of the Gaonim, who had the original book with 613 mitzvot, and the Rambam disagreed with many of the mitzvot that the Bahag counted. So one of the Rambam's rules is he says you cannot count a mitzvah which is only temporary, right? If, you know, Hashem told Moshe to make a copper snake in Parashas Chukas. There's no mitzvah in Taryag to make a copper snake, right? That's a mitzvah for just a generation. So the Rambam says if you have a mitzvah for just temporary, that's not included in Taryag. So the Rambam says, therefore, which mitzvah is not going to be included in my count of 613 mitzvos? The mitzvah not to attack Edom, Moab, or Ammon. Why? We didn't attack him, right? We had to go all the way around those countries. So the Rambam says, no problem. Those were only mitzvos which were relevant in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. The whole point was when you come into the land, you can't attack Edom or Moab, but subsequent generations were allowed to. What's the proof in the pudding that David attacks Edom and David attacks Moab over here? Fine. That's what the Rambam says. But the Ramban has a whole essay. This is the very, very end of what the Ramban writes. Now, the Ramban goes through all the Rambam's mitzvos. And after the Rambam went after the Gaonim, the Ramban goes after the Rambam. And the Ramban says, you know, this mitzvah you got to drop, and this mitzvah you got to drop. And by the end, the Ramban has crossed off about 50 mitzvahs from the Rambam's count. But of course, now the Ramban is kind of stuck because we know the number is 613. So if you cross them out, you got to bring in new ones. So the Ramban does that. The Ramban has his shikchas halavin, right? The shikchas ha'esen. Here are the mitzvahs that the Rambam forgot to count. He goes through them one by one. Okay. Then at the very end, the Ramban has an essay where he talks about the mitzvah to not attack Ammon or Moab. Ramban says, truth is, it's not so obvious that this is a mitzvah li'shah, that it's a temporary mitzvah. In Pesukim, it seems like it was a permanent commandment. Do not attack them. Okay. So why is it that nobody who ever counted 613 mitzvahs counted a mitzvah to not attack Ammon or Moab or Edom? Gemara does not really talk about the halachos of this. So why not? So the Ramban quotes a couple of midrashim which describe Yoav going to attack the nations in this parak. And all of a sudden, the Medrash says that all these nations became Bible scholars because they all waived the prohibition to attack them. Moab we can't attack, right? Torah tells us in Dvarim, you're going Esav, Al Tiskerubam, you know, don't attack Edom, Al Tatsaras Moab, don't attack Moab, don't attack Ammon. The Medrash points out. We're not supposed to attack Aram. Why? Because who's the ancestor of Aram? Lavan. And when Yaakov Avinu leaves Aram, he made a non-aggression treaty with Lavan. I stay on my side of the rock. You stay on your side of the rock. So, you know, the Midrashim themselves are really beautiful and worth going through inside. But just for our purposes, short version of the story is, David asks Sanhedrin, what's going on over here? The answer is, they started it. The mitzvah was, do not wage a war of aggression against Ammon or Moab or Edom. Do not cross over the rock to attack Aram. That was relevant when Bnei Yisrael was coming into Eretz Yisrael the first time. But a lot of things have changed in the last 360, almost 400 years. Namely, we've been attacked by every single one of those nations multiple times. From the very beginning of Shoftim, when Aram attacks in the time of Othniel and Moab attacks in the time of of Ehud, to Shaul's era, where the Navi said explicitly that Shaul had to fight defensive wars against all of these different countries, they've been attacking us for generations. Once that happens, then the mitzvah is not relevant because the commandment was Al Tatsaras Moab. You should not provoke them. Well, if they're fighting you, if it's a defensive war, then you are allowed to attack. Okay, so that explains why David is allowed to fight them. Just parenthetically, is kind of haunting because we're learning now that a bris can be broken, right? A treaty, if the treaty is broken, it's dead. So we were told not to fight. You know, we made a treaty with Aram, made a treaty, or Hashem made a treaty for us with Edom and Moab and Ammon. But hey, if they break it, it's broken. Well, we should think that one parak ago, Hashem made a bris with David, right? That he's going to have an eternal dynasty. So if the covenants here of not attacking other nations can be broken, so we might wonder about David one parak ago. Okay, I'll just put that on the back burner. But the Ramban says that's exactly what's happening over here. But then Ramban quotes a Gemara in the Yerushalmi. It happens to be, it's just ridiculous. It's unbelievable. And the Ramban just says, he has everything. He's like super obscure Midrash. And he quotes this Yerushalmi in Rosh Hashanah. And the Yerushalmi in Rosh Hashanah asks about a contradiction about how long David ruled for. How long did David rule? So, you know, David ruled for 40 years. Right? 7 years in Hebron and 33 years in Yerushalayim. However, in Sefer Shmuel, we're told the details. We're told that he actually ruled for 40 and a half years. So why are 6 months dropped? So the Yerushalmi says, well, 6 months were dropped because in Sefer Malachim we're told that Yoav fought in Edom for 6 months. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ani amarti al titkar bam va'ata hiskarisa bam. I said, don't fight Edom. You're fighting Edom. Those 6 months are going to be dropped from the count of your reign. So Ramban now needs to explain. Other Midrashim are telling us, and it seems pretty clear. I mean, Hashem himself, the Navi said twice, helped David win these battles. So how can Hashem help David win the battles and yet David be criticized for attacking Edom? It doesn't make any sense. So the Ramban says, let me explain. Hakarov mipnei sha'asa bahem nekama yoser midai. That David went too far in taking revenge. Was the battle allowed? Yes. Is there revenge here? Did they do terrible things to us? Absolutely. But nonetheless, says the Ramban, we still can say that the Pesukim are indicating to us that things went too far. In Sefer Malachim and Yoav wipes out every male, that was going too far. Wait, maybe when David is killing the 2/3 of Moab, that is also going too far. Nekama yoser midai, ki bachristo kol zachar mehem sham avad shemam ufila nukacha nachsam mehem. That's going too far. So, you know, if we think of Rashi, Abarbanel, and the Ramban, I think this really just opens up for us methodologically these three different approaches we can take. We have the Medrash of Rashi, which just makes so many other pieces that don't make sense in the story fit. And then we walk away with it, with really things being, you know, totally positive for David. And there's no question that the parak as a whole is totally positive for David. As we said, I mean, it's like Avraham Avinu, and the focus is on the Beis HaMikdash, not on the spoils. You have the pshat of the Abarbanel, which fits the local pasuk, but it's like too much pshat. I mean, even the Abarbanel steps back from it. But that is the raw read of the pasuk itself. And then you have the Ramban, which is somewhere in the middle, right? You know, this is not terrible. It's not what we have to, there's plenty of context we need to add and to provide. But at the end of the day, there still is a piece where, you know, there is a reason why the pasuk were written in a way that we should come out sensing that something is wrong. And indeed, right, the Ramban is saying that's exactly what none other than Chazal themselves and the Gemara Yerushalmi here were identifying. That there was something wrong. There can be a justified approach, but taking it too far, and that is what happens over here. Okay, so I'll stop here. If anyone has any questions, it'd be great. Otherwise, it's great to be back and looking forward to more learning Rosh Hashem next week.
Oh, sorry, just the quickest question. Yeah. David's mother, does she ever appear anywhere in the Pshat? How the Mefarsh, how Rashi said Aviv v'Imo, and not just like Mishpachto or Aviv v'Echav?
Yeah, what about his sisters? Because I was wondering about that too, the truth is. Because David's sister is Yoav's mother. So if David's, Tsruya is David's sister. So if Tsruya was murdered, then that would then Yoav also has personal revenge over here. So I wonder how literally narrow that line should be, as opposed to just being like code word for the whole family. Not sure.
Interesting. Right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Yeah. Shkach, everybody.
Thank you.
Lila Tov. Stay warm.
Thank you. You too.